Hey friend, welcome to Girls Night, where we work through life's biggest decisions and transitions together. I'm Stephanie Mae Wilson, and on this show, we talk about the everything era. That wildly confusing decade-ish, where we have to make some of the most significant decisions of our lives, typically all at the same time. If you're anything like me, it probably feels like a lot. How do you even know what you want out of life? And even once you've figured that out, how do you make it happen? Thankfully, each week I get to sit down with some of the smartest women I know and have them walk us through the topics that keep us up at night. We get to learn from both their experience and their expertise, and you'll walk away from each episode not only knowing what your next step is, but with the support you need to actually take it. No matter who you are, where you come from, or what decisions you end up making, you're welcome here. Get comfy and let's get started. I am so excited about today's episode. Today, we're talking about how to make decisions in pregnancy and in the first few months after your baby is born. There are so many myths and misconceptions floating around, and today, we're gonna work through some of them. In the first few months after my girls were born, I spent so much time Googling, wondering, when does this get easier? Am I doing this right? Am I going to mess up my kids? Should I do this or this? Should I buy this product or that product? I was totally overwhelmed by the responses to my Google searches. One, because there were about a million of them. It's so great to live in an age where the wisdom of the world is at our fingertips, but when you're exhausted and already so overwhelmed, that amount of information can be a lot. To make it even harder is the fact that a lot of the information conflicts. People have different ideas about the right way to do things, and they are sure that their way is the right way. So in this episode, we're gonna talk about how to filter through that information, how to figure out what's right for you and for your particular family. Our guest for today's episode is my new friend, Emily Oster. Emily is a New York Times bestselling author, professor of economics at Brown University, and founder and CEO of Parent Data, a data-driven guide to pregnancy, parenting, and more. I've been following Emily's work for years now, and when I tell you that she changed and maybe even saved my life as a mom, that is not an exaggeration. She is my number one go-to source for parenting information. Emily's science-backed resources and research have given me so much peace of mind, especially in the early stages of motherhood, and my hope is that she can do the same for you. You ready? Let's dive in.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
All right, friends, I am like truly over the moon about who you get to meet today. I am sitting here with, I'll have to introduce her to you in a second and tell you like what she means to me, but I'm going to go ahead and call her my parenting guru, my parenting go-to, Emily Oster. Emily, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk.
This is so fun. Okay, so for women who haven't read all of your books yet, tell us who you are, what you do, and a fun fact about yourself.
So I'm a professor of economics at Brown University, and I'm a writer. I write about pregnancy and parenting. I have three books, Expecting Better, Crib Sheet, and The Family Farm, and they all take a data-based approach to parenting and pregnancy, trying to help people understand what the data really says about the questions that we all have, and usually trying to dial down the panic and help people feel more confident in their choices. I have two kids. They're 12 and 8, so they're kind of big now. And I live in Rhode Island. And a fun fact about me is that I am afraid to use the telephone. I am like, I don't like to call people on the phone, like to the point of not just for a hard conversation, but like to call to order pizza. Like I wouldn't do that. I find that very anxiety provoking. I'm just afraid of the phone.
That is
so amazing. This is why we do the fun fact, because we're sitting here with economics professors, brilliant women who are afraid to talk on the phone, never in fight, and we're okay. We're okay. We're all okay.
Yeah. Now that's why I got married, because my husband's great on the phone. So I just be like, can you call people? Mm-hmm.
I remember distinctly my sister and I, we would order pizza like every Saturday night growing up. And we would always debate like, okay, it's your turn. You have to call. No, you have to call. They ask you questions you don't see coming, even though you should have thought through your pizza order ahead of time. Like, I don't know. It's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot.
So there you go.
All right.
The phone. Terrifying, terrifying adventure.
Can do lots of other things. Not the phone.
Not the phone.
Okay. I love that. Well, so Emily, I haven't given you sort of the backstory yet, but I want to. So I am a mom of twin girls. They are three, and they were born in November 2020. And so we were in the height of the pandemic. We were new parents to twins. They were healthy, didn't spend any time in the NICU, but still like pretty like underweight. Their weight was a concern right away. And so feeding them was really hard. They had reflux, spit up all the time. We had no idea what we were doing. And we had, blessedly, and also this was a little tricky, we had our families living with us at the time, because my family lives in Colorado and we're like, you're not going to get to see the babies unless you really make a trip out here. And so my family like quarantined and drove out here and then lived with us. My sister was with us for 6 weeks, which was amazing. But we had all of this like chaos basically going on. We're feeding the girls around the clock, never getting more than 90 minutes of sleep at a time, either my husband or I. It was like, we had like six people on these babies and we're still getting our butts kicked. And in the middle of the night, as we're up feeding the girls, we're Googling. And we're both firstborn, type A, high achievers. Like, how can we fix this? Like, there has to be a way to hack this to make this less like, this is going to kill me than it is. And we found, so the two big questions that I was asking were sleep training, because immediately I was like, these kids have to sleep, otherwise I'm going to perish. And feeding them. And I didn't have super strong feelings about breastfeeding going into it, I didn't think. But the second they were born, the hospital gave us a bottle. They're like, they're small. We need to like bulk these kids up. We can't wait for your like milk to catch up. We don't know if it's going to. And so we were like tandem feeding, triple feeding, like pumping, all the things. And I didn't realize that I was going to have feelings about not being able to exclusively breastfeed them, but I did. And to this day, I don't know where that came from, but I really, really wrestled with this feeling of like failing them, even though I would have told any of my friends that that is crap. And so this is like kind of the environment that we're in. And we're sitting up in the middle of the night, we're Googling all these things, and we're finding a bazillion people who are thrilled to speak into our situation and who are doing so and conflicting reports immediately. We're scared. We're like, everything causes SIDS. And like, you know, we're just totally freaking out. And at the time, I was connected to a wonderful postpartum therapist who I still see. She's just become my person. And she said, you guys need to quiet some of the voices that you're listening to, and you need to pick your gurus. That's the phrase she said, pick your gurus. And she said, one of my favorite people is Emily Oster. And she clears through or takes all of the things that you're reading online and like sifts through them and helps figure out what's like actually real. And I had a friend give me Expecting Better, and I like didn't read it before the girls were born, but I read Crib Sheets immediately. And that was the first time I felt like peace as a mom. I felt like I was able, like I felt like I was equipped to make informed decisions about my kid's life and about my life. And so I really felt like I was able to move forward and go, okay, that's not true. This is what's true. I don't have to worry about this. I am going to worry about this and move forward. And so,
You're gonna make me cry.
I mean, this is everyone's story that's come across your work. So I tell that to everyone. I'm like, pick your gurus, because everyone on the internet is going to tell you different things. And like, if you want mine, her name's Emily Oster, and I'm going to buy you her book. So anyway, that is the landscape in which I found you. And the reason I wanted to have you on the show, I mean, you talk about so many different things that we could get into, but I basically wanted to ask you about some of the things that were the biggest issues for me. Yeah. and just basically like introduce you to my women so that they have you as a resource also for whatever thing is that they are like that they end up struggling with.
I love it. I mean, I think, so first of all, that's like, yeah, you really are going to make me cry because this is where like, what you describe is where I want to be for people is a place to feel like you're like confident in your decisions and comfortable in the choices you make, and to do that by providing some guidance, but also by trying to answer the question of why and sort of giving you the confidence to feel like those are decisions you've thought through and made, as opposed to like, I just did this because this person said it, or then this person said it, they told me something else. Just to quiet the voices is such a nice way to put it.
Oh, well, seriously, that's exactly where it was. And like, I can picture, it's the middle of the night. And I just am like, okay, all right, we're going to be okay.
It's going to be fine. Going to do it.
Oh my gosh. So I want to hear like the backstory for you, because I don't think I really know this. How did this all start? Like, you're an economist and you're a parenting expert. Like, how did these two come together?
Yeah. So it started when I got pregnant. So I got pregnant with my daughter, who's now 12. And that was, you know, I guess 13 years ago-ish. And I found the advice in pregnancy really confusing. And there were a lot of rules and a lot of things that people were saying and a lot of noise around many of these restrictions and many of the choices we had to make. I mean, a lot of the stuff in pregnancy, you know, ranging from can I have sushi to, you know, when is my baby going to come, to like, should I be on bed rest? All this kind of stuff. And so the origin of Expecting Better, which is the book on pregnancy, is really the research that I did for myself in my pregnancy. And, you know, it's sort of that book kind of, it's interesting. I went back to revise it this year and I can feel the like anxiety and sort of the rawness almost of those moments of early pregnancy, where now I look back on it in a much more dispassionate way, but it really was a kind of a book I felt like I had to poop it out. You know, it's like I had to put it out there because this was so important to me to understand these choices. So I wrote that book and then I published it, and sort of thinking like, okay, now I've like gotten out this thing that I felt was really important to me, and maybe some people will read it. And it did fine at the beginning. And then it sort of did better over time. I think in the end, the book really resonated with the people who read it. And then they sent it to their friends. And then it sort of, then I had a second kid. And then that is really the origin of Crib Sheet. Because part of, for me, the most important distinction between kid one and kid two was the ability with the second kid to focus on the things that were important and to know what was coming so I could think about it in advance and like make decisions in a holistic manner. You know, I don't like, with my first kid, it was like every minute of those first year was just some other insane panic ranging from like, you know, my mom once told me that if I put mittens on her, she would never learn to use her hands. Just like, I don't know. Like, and then I'm like, oh my God, but she's going to scratch her face. But also then I want her to use her hands. Like, that's so important. Hands, they come up all the time as an adult. I'm constantly using, you know. And so it's like that kind of thing where now I look back, I'm like, first of all, why did she say that? And second of all, like, why did I even listen? I should have been like, okay, thanks. Like, you know.
Because you don't know anything.
You don't know anything.
So tired. It is I will never get over the fact that you have like the most physically grueling thing, like in birth or a C-section. I had a C-section. So it was like pretty cushy. Like I went in and I just sat for my appointment and then, but then
would not describe major abdominal surgery as like a spa day.
Yeah. And then I had a major abdominal surgery. But then like the second they're born, they hand them to you and they go, okay, keep them alive. And you're like, okay, I took the classes. Like I read the books. Yeah. I have no idea what I'm doing. I didn't know how to, okay, again, I took the hospital classes.
Me too.
I did not
tell
know
you
how,
anything.
No, yeah. Like, and also you don't remember it. It was like months ago. I didn't know how to change a diaper until 10 days into my girl's life because I couldn't get out of bed. So I'm like, I'm sitting there. I'm in charge of the feeding. People keep handing me babies and I hand them back and they change their diapers. So finally, once I was like mobile, I had to look at my husband and be like, okay, so like, how are you doing this again? Like,
Is there a diagram?
Is there a trick to it? Which way is the front? And so anyway, I figured I could put a diaper on anything at this point. But then
for me, then the second kid had much less of that panic. And it because again, like many of these, like first of all, you kind of know what you're doing. You understand a little bit more what's happening. But I realized, of course, with the second kid, there are still all of these really quite important decisions, which are very fraught and which you want to think about and we all want to do a good job. And so the crib sheet is really like, it's the book I wrote after the second kid, which is, you know, here are the 15 or 17 like things which you're really going to be thinking about a lot. And you're kind of from 0 to 3. And here's what the data says on those. And it's breastfeeding and it's sleep training, it's co-sleeping, it's potty training, it sort of like ends at about potty training. So, you know, that's where I come from. That's my thing.
What is your life like? You're currently a professor. You're also currently writing books. What is like, what do you teach classes actively?
I do. I teach less than most people. So I teach basically one class a year. And then I sort of also do all of this parent data writing and the kind of a lot of this parenting stuff. So I'm a little split right now between these different activities. But I teach classes about like, my class is called The Economics of Social Policy. It's like a upper level elective for undergraduates.
That's so awesome. That's so awesome. Friends, I love a good smelling home just as much as the next person. But there's nothing worse than lighting a candle with a scent that is way too overpowering and ends up giving you a headache. On top of that, I recently learned that the candle industry contributes to a massive amount of carbon emissions and toxicity in our air. Because of this, I recently made it my mission to find a candle without the harsh chemicals and that was better for the planet. Thankfully, it does exist, and that's why I made the switch to Notes Candles, which also happens to be today's Girls' Night sponsor. I love Notes because their scents are high quality, but they don't smell overly sweet or chemical-y. But what's even more amazing is that they're on a mission to help eliminate single-use candle vessels with their more earth-friendly options. Did you know that there are almost 2 billion candles sold each year, and almost all of them are likely to end up in landfills for the next 1 million years? Wow, talk about wasteful. But thankfully, Notes does things differently with their refillable candle system that allows you to use your candle vessel again and again and again. I love this because it's way more sustainable than buying a new candle jar every time you go to the store, and you don't have to feel guilty about throwing your old candle jars in the trash. Plus, it's easy to do and actually really fun. You just place the wick they provide you in your reusable Notes jar. You fill it up with their wax beads, light your candle, and enjoy your fragrance for up to 36 hours. Once you're ready for a new candle, you just repeat the same steps. They have 13 incredible fragrances to choose from, which are all handcrafted by fragrance experts at the Notes home base in South Carolina. I am obsessed with their vanilla and pepperwood scent. It's cozy and warm and perfect for a movie night with your friends. They also have other amazing fragrances like pistachio and rose water, linen and crisp air, and bamboo and water lily. I cannot wait to use their pistachio and rose water scent this spring. Be a responsible consumer while not giving up high quality home fragrance by making the switch to Notes. Make the switch and build a starter kit. Right now, Notes is giving listeners 15% off and free shipping when you buy a Notes starter kit using the code GIRLSNIGHT at notescandle.com/GIRLSNIGHT. Just use code GIRLSNIGHT when placing your order. That's code GIRLSNIGHT at notescandle.com/GIRLSNIGHT. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friend, how are you? How are you really? I don't know about you, but once springtime hits, it feels like there's a lot more activities happening in my life, from social gatherings to family outings to work meetings. While those are all great things, if I'm not careful, my social battery starts to feel a little bit drained. I've learned that the best thing I can do for myself when I'm feeling this way is to pause and figure out what is filling my cup and what isn't. And the thing that has helped me sort through those feelings the most is therapy. Tell me if any of this sounds familiar. You're going through something really hard right now, a big loss or a gigantic life transition. You frequently feel anxious, depressed, overwhelmed, or just generally discouraged. Especially lately, the world is such a hard place to live in right now. You really, really, really want your life circumstances to change, but you don't know how to actually change them. Or you're feeling stuck as you try to work through your past, navigate your present, or figure out your future. Friend, if you can relate to any of this, you're not alone. I've been there, and therapy has been the thing that has helped me more than anything else with all of this. In the last 10 years or so, I've learned that strength isn't proving I can do it on my own. It's knowing that I don't have to. I'm at my strongest when I have a full support system around me, and an essential part of my support system is therapy. Therapy can be absolutely life-changing. That is, if you can afford it and find a therapist you like and trust. But of course, this is all easier said than done. And that's why I'm so excited to be partnering with this week's podcast sponsor. Our sponsor for today's episode is BetterHelp. BetterHelp is the easiest and most affordable way I've ever found to find a great therapist. It's entirely online and super easy to sign up. You can get started right away, and if you don't love the counselor you're paired with, switching is easy and it's free. If you're going through something hard in your relationships, or you're in a funk you just can't shake, if you've been feeling anxious or depressed lately, or if your social battery is drained and you need some help balancing your everyday life and schedule, BetterHelp is an incredible resource for you. And I'm so thankful they've given me a promo code that I can share with you to make it even easier to get started. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/friendship today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/friendship. Okay, well, I love hearing that. I want to, like I said, I want to dig into a couple of the things that were like particularly stressful for me because like, I mean, really everyone has kind of their own thing of like, this is the thing keeping me up. Well, no, a baby's keeping you up at night, but this is what's causing me stress while I'm up at night.
This is what I'm doing while I'm up. This is what I'm panic Googling while I'm awake.
Uh-huh, yes. So I want to, before we get into like the nitty gritty, one of the things I think that is the most powerful that you teach overall is how to analyze data. And I mean, we're living in an age where there's more information than there's ever been ever. There's more misinformation than there's ever been ever. And there are more people who just like have an opinion that are good at making good blogs that just like put it out in the world. And you're like, wait, is that, no, that's not a thing. What are some filters that we can run things through, like no matter what we're looking at, before we take something to heart?
Yeah, it's tough. So I think there's a few different filters of this. So one is there's a distinction between like research, there's research on this topic and like, this is what I think from sort of theory or from some imaginary thing I've got in my head. And that distinction I think is sometimes easier to make because you can sort of understand, is someone telling you, you know, this is something that I have from my own experience or, you know, from my whatever it is, as opposed to this is something in data. But I deal with a lot of, I'm not sure you would call it misinformation, but maybe misinterpretation of data and studies. So, and a lot of that is really in this panic headline space. So for example, yesterday on Instagram, there's a headline from a very reputable, from Good Morning America, that's like screen time exposure before the age of one, you know, is causing sensory issues for kids. And that's the kind of headline you see all the time.
Yeah.
And when you look at the paper, that's just not what it says. Like this is there is a correlation. It's very likely driven by, in that case, the opposite effect. The kids who already have some sensory issues are watching more screens because that's one of the ways their parents are dealing with that. And so then when you see them have sensory issues later, it's not that it was caused by the screens. It's like what we call reverse causality. So, and this is out in the world all the time. And you ask, why is that out in the world? And the answer is like, because people click on it, because you're clicking on that post, you know, because that's because we're drawn to fear. That's what sells clicks. And so I think, you know, one thing I urge people to do is just take a moment, take a step back, think about, you know, what do we know about this in general? is it likely that this effect is causal? And that's like a hard question. And that sounds like a very technical question, but I think it is something you can think about for yourself. Like, does it seem likely that the people whose kids watch more TV versus less TV, that those people are otherwise identical? And you could ask that question about many kinds of choices. You know, does it seem likely that people who breastfeed for 2 years are identical to the people who don't breastfeed at all, except for this one dimension? Like, no, that doesn't seem like it's true. And so I think just digging into it a little bit is good. But I also, like, for my taste, I wish that more of these media outlets would be a little more, maybe they could read through the whole paper, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and so because you're talking to people who are really vulnerable.
They're really vulnerable. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
What are some of the most common misconceptions that you see floating around about pregnancy specifically, where you're like, for the love, stop telling people that?
So I think there's a lot of stuff about food that is not supported by data. A lot of these food restrictions, like no sushi, you know, no deli meats of any kind, that stuff is just not well supported by data. There isn't a lot of, it's not well supported by data. It's just not like well supported by biology. We're sort of tarring many things with the same brush. And I think for me, that's irritating because I think it causes people have a limited amount of focus. So if you tell them, you know, here's 45 things you can't eat, they're going to forget maybe the two that actually you shouldn't eat. Better to tell them, here are the 5 things you really shouldn't eat. You know, really don't smoke, but let's not pretend that smoking and caffeine are sort of comparable. Like, one of them has a much better evidence base than the other. So that's just like a space that bugs me. The one very specific thing is bed rest. So there's just nothing for which bed rest has shown to be effective. Basically no complication for which that's a good idea. And there's many reasons why you wouldn't want to put people on bed rest. Like, it makes labor harder and makes recovery harder and all that kinds of stuff. And yet it's still widely prescribed.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. 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 Oh, I feel like your job has to be really frustrating and satisfying all at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I love getting to do this because it feels like sometimes I get to help people. And that's like an unbelievable privilege and something I never would have anticipated. You know, like, I mean, I think my economics papers are like, I develop statistical methods. That's like my space in economics. And so, like, sometimes people use them in their papers and, like, that's nice. But no one ever tells me, like, you really changed my life with this, like, procedure for evaluating omitted variable bias. Very, very rarely comes up.
Yeah. right over my head.
Yeah. It's like,
okay. Well, so I want to dig into the things that have been like, I want everyone to get to hear the things that I got to hear from you in the middle of my panic. The first thing really is breastfeeding. I feel like half of the internet says fed is best. The other half, maybe it isn't, some people probably say this specifically, but more insinuate that, like, you're the worst mom ever if you don't give your kid breast milk. And that there are, like, long-term repercussions of your decision. What does the data actually say?
Yeah. So if you look at, like, a list of kind of what are the claimed benefits of breast milk, it's very long. It contains a lot of things that are about long-term health of kids. So it'll make your kids smarter. It'll make them less disease prone when they're older. So all kinds of, make them thinner, like all kinds of stuff about the future. And I think that's where some of this pressure that can be really overwhelming for a lot of people can come from. This idea that, like, if I made a different choice, if I chose not to breastfeed my kid, that would be setting them up for some long-term worseness. And when you look at the data, well, so let me tell you first why some of those results are not very compelling, which is that, so take something like IQ. On average, women who breastfeed have more education than those who do not. There's like a strong education wealth gradient in breastfeeding for a bunch of different reasons. And so the children of, and those things, mom's education is also very highly correlated with how her kid performs on tests. So it's extremely difficult, basically impossible, to separate the impact of all the other features of mom from the impact of breastfeeding. When you do a better job of that, like say when you compare two siblings, one of whom's breastfed and one of whom's not, so they've got the same family environment, everything is the same, sort of to the as much as you can make it the same, but one's breastfed and one's not, you don't see anything. No differences in IQ there. That is true of many of these long-term benefits of breastfeeding. Now, that is not to say that there aren't some short-term benefits. So it does seem like in the first year, there's a lower risk of gastrointestinal issues, maybe a lower risk of allergies, sort of eczema in the first year, and maybe a lower risk of ear infections. So, and for babies who are in the NICU, there are some additional digestive benefits. So those things are all real. So I think in the sense of like, if you said, you know, breast is best, I think that's, there's like a technical sense in which that is kind of true in the sense that there may be some benefits, but it is in no, it's nowhere close to the way that people talk about this in terms of its impact. And I think for me, what I would like to tell people about this is something that is closer to the truth. Like, hey, some people really like breastfeeding. I'd love for you to try it and let's see what kind of support you need to see if it's something that works for you. And, you know, there could be some short-term health benefits for your baby. That feels like a kind of honest way to approach people with breastfeeding, as opposed to like, I'm sorry that you're depressed and your nipples are bleeding, but if you quit doing this activity, you're a terrible mom.
And doing which your is kids just, their whole life.
Right. And you've done them forever. But, you know, look, if you're like a person who loves your nipples, like, I guess you can quit. You know, it's like there's a little bit of this attitude, and this comes up in so many things of parenting, this attitude of like, well, if you just care about yourself, and that's so damaging, because I think actually caring about yourself is really important for caring about your baby. I mean, these are not separable. Like, you know, one of my co-authors, I write some stuff with a guy named Nate Fox, who's a doctor, and he's always telling me like, happy mom, happy baby. Like, you know, the thing we got to think about is like, how are we supporting mom? And that's infinitely more important than the particular details of, you know, how many ounces of breast milk are you getting every day?
Tell me more. I want to know more about that, because it is like, it does feel like you are supposed to wring yourself out and then more and more and more. Like there's no, the limit does not exist of yeah. like how far it feels like you're supposed to push yourself for what feels like it's good for your baby. But the reason your work is so important is because sometimes we're pouring ourselves out or like harming ourselves for something that doesn't matter that much. But is there data to support like that mom's happiness, mom's health, mom's well-being is good for
totally. The baby? I mean, we have plenty of data to suggest that sort of in the extreme forms of this, like postpartum depression, where women are like sort of feel disconnected, that can have consequences for them, for their kids in the long term. So I think there's sort of plenty of things in the space of like postpartum depression, anxiety can be damaging for kids and for moms, which is not to say like if you're depressed, you're a terrible parent, which is like, again, how people are going to hear that, but just that there are so many different pieces of what makes a happy and healthy and like successful isn't the word I'm looking for, like balanced family. And when we get very focused on one vertical or one behavior, we like miss the whole picture. I think some of what I want people to take away from this when they think about their own parenting is like step back a little bit and ask like, what am I trying to craft here? Like there are three people or four, in your case, four people in this new little dyad. Like how are we trying to sort of serve that unit and everybody in that unit rather than having this almost singular focus on not just a singular focus on the baby, which I think would already miss a little bit with the parents, but a singular focus on one particular behavior, and which just isn't, that's not going to support the whole dyad.
Yeah.
The whole unit.
Talk to me about sleep training. Sleep training versus breastfeeding, they kind of came into conflict for us, because the more support we got for breastfeeding, the more people said, you know, you need to be feeding them on demand. You can't have them on a schedule. The very first advice we got when we found out we were having twins was you need to have them on a schedule and you need to keep them on the same schedule. And don't you dare like take them off. You will never sleep. And so we're like, okay, well, that's confusing. And then also as we started to look into sleep training, it was like, no, a schedule is really important. And it became clear eventually that like maybe it, the thing that was holding us back in like my ability to produce enough milk for both babies really was that I like had them on a schedule. Like maybe that really would have made the difference. I don't know. But that would have meant that like no one slept at all. Yeah. And that's how kind of the two like came up against one another. But sleep training was so interesting because we were like, okay, you know, we've heard a little bit about this. We're going to start walking down this road. I Google, is sleep training dangerous? You know exactly where this is going. Yeah. I Google,
is sleep training bad? Everyone's favorite Google.
Is sleep training harmful to your baby? Because it's like, I can't like leave this kid to cry in their bed. That sounds horrible. The very first response, at least at the time, was from a psychologist who we love, writing a personal essay, which that wasn't totally clear to me in the middle of the night. But she cited that study about, is it Romanian orphans?
Mm-hmm.
Orphans in Romania that were left to cry in their beds and eventually stopped crying because they knew no one was going to come, right?
Yeah.
First answer. So you're okay. Like, so yeah, this is is damaging. I can't do this.
All right. So I actually want to start with, people ask about sleep training. I think we often start with this question of like, is it bad? And I actually think it's useful for this to start by talking about like, what would be the reason to sleep train and what do we know about the evidence on that? So, and this is a place actually where evidence is pretty good because they have randomized trials. So they have randomized trials where some kids are sort of sleep trained. And by that, I mean, sort of, we can talk about some of the details, but some version of like crying it out at some points in the night. So then they fall asleep and they sleep better. So we have randomized trials where some kids are treated in that way and some kids are not. And then they follow them even up through 5 or 6 years old. So we have sort of relatively long follow-up and good causality and all this stuff. So the reason that many of these studies existed in the first place was to try to look for impacts on parental functioning, right? So many of these studies are not designed to see like, does sleep training ruin your children? The studies are designed to see like, does this improve things for parents? And I think that's actually a really important thing to say because like it does. I mean, so what is the impact of sleep training? For many babies, it improves their sleep. It's not a magic bullet. Like not everybody sleeps through the night after 2 nights of sleep training. Kids vary a lot in their variation, in their response. But like on average, there is a good response. And on average, parental maternal depression declines, parental marital satisfaction improves. There are some of these studies where they like bring people in sort of pretty extreme situations like into the lab. They like on intake, like 70% of them are screening depressive. You know, 4 days later, like 10% of them are screening depressive. You know, partly because just like if you have not slept, that is a mechanism of torture. That is a way we literally torture people. And it's very difficult to have a sort of coherent emotional response to anything if you are so exhausted. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's just the first thing to say about sleep training. Then there's the second piece, which is like when we look at these data with long-term follow-up and short-term follow-up and whatever on babies, we just don't see anything. We don't see anything. You know, if any, like parents report their kids are a little happier after sleep training. I always interpret that as like parents are happier, but anyway, whatever. Like they look a little happier. There isn't anything that looks like a problem. And then in the long term, there's just no differences. So we're just not seeing like anything. Now, does that mean you have to sleep train? No. Some people will tell me, and actually people will say their pediatricians like telling them like you must sleep train it like at 12 weeks, like close the door and don't go back in. And that's not for everybody. I think this is a pretty personal choice. Yeah. But if your thing is like, I need to do this because this is what we need to like make this work, there's just no reason not to. Now, on the Romanian orphans, which is the place where this often comes from, this idea that like, you know, there was this sort of terrible incident in sort of time period in Romania when many kids were basically abandoned because of some deep failures of reproductive policy. But it's not that these kids were put in a room by loving parents after like a day of snuggles and then had the door closed and they, you know, they cried and they went to sleep. And then in the morning, someone was there to like hug them again. That's not what was happening. These kids were subject to like extreme physical and sexual abuse over long periods of time in these like terrible orphanage conditions. They were left for like days with basically no human contact. I mean, it's just completely, it's a terrible, terrible incident, which bears effectively no resemblance to the sleep training that we are talking about when we talk about that in like this conversation.
Okay, I didn't remember some of those details. I'm so glad you said that though, because it really does feel like so, it's really hard to hear your baby cry and to not like immediately step in. And it does feel like, are they going to stop crying because they think no one's coming? And like,
they're going to stop crying because I think you're, in some ways, I think we attribute a bit too much. Like they're going to stop crying because they learn to fall asleep, and they learn to fall asleep the same way like our kids are going to learn a bunch of things as they age.
Yeah. Yeah.
I always think the distinction that sort of the big conflict with sleep training is sort of sleep training versus co-sleeping, because actually like, although those are discussed often in quite different like sets of people, they're actually both ways that can enhance parent sleep in entirely different ways. So for a lot of people with infants, like co-sleeping is the way that they are able to, like their kid can sleep better. They don't have to get up. They, you know, so for some people, that's the argument they'll give me for why they're co-sleeping. And one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, how do you think about co-sleeping as safely as possible, knowing that there are some risks, but you know, sleep is such a fraught issue.
Yeah. Especially when you don't have any.
Right. That's the worst thing.
It's absolutely the worst thing. Yeah. We did sleep train, did end up sleep training our kids. And it's the thing about it is like, I think you imagine that it's this like one size fits all, like really sudden kind of thing. And there are so many different programs that are really good and helpful. And our girls are like remarkably wonderful sleepers, and it has totally changed our life. And no, I would say theirs too.
Yeah. I mean, sleep is really important for kids. Like sleep is really important. It's like I'm always on it because now I have older kids. And so we're like up against with my older one, like this sort of like, how do you get your 12-year-old enough sleep when there's all this stuff going on? And, you know, so, and I'm just like a complete like sleep. I'm so strict on sleep.
Oh man. We are big, big on sleep here.
Love it.
So this is, gosh, another thing that is so fraught. I think in Crib Sheets, you talk about how you and your family put together kind of like the family math of who works, who makes how much money you need to live, who stays home, and if no one is staying home, who cares for your kids? How did you, hearing your process, like you talk about what this looked like for you was really helpful for me. So can you talk about like, how did you guys figure this out? Like in your specific family?
Yeah. So the way that I sort of talk about in general is the idea of like thinking about what's like the optimal configuration of adult work hours, right? So we sort of are it's so common to think about this in this binary of like stay at home mom versus not stay at home mom, which is not necessarily the only choice. It's often not the only choice. I think for our family, like both of us working was always something was going to happen. And I think that was a really important thing to recognize at the beginning was like, my job is really important to me. I really like it. And I've talked about this before, like I love my kids. They're wonderful. And I like to be with them, and I have a high taste for time with them. And I am more or less the default parent, but I really also love my job. And like, I spend a lot of time at my job and I work really hard. And I feel like it is sometimes not okay to say like, I have a job because I like it, which is true here. Like we would be financially worse off if I didn't work, but like we could make it work. But, and so that's, I don't have a job in this case because I need to. I'm very lucky to say that, but I have it because I like it, because it's important to me. And that's sometimes can be surprisingly controversial to say. Mm-hmm. And I think once we recognize that, then for us, the question was, you know, what's the kind of childcare that, what's the sort of configuration of childcare that we would need? And we had a nanny early on, and we've had a bunch of different childcare arrangements over time. But I think it's really those kind of decisions for me are very, it's very important to be deliberate about them and think about, you know, what's feasible? What do I want my day to look like? And, you know, how do we, is there a way to sort of craft the life that you love, craft the hours that you love? And I will say, like, as my kids have gotten bigger, my taste for time with them has gone up, which has been a really interesting experience. And so I sort of try to respect that and figure out, you know, I probably don't travel as much as I should if I wanted to like maximize my professional success, because I really hate being away and because my husband can't make lunches and stuff like that. It generates a lot of chaos, but it's just mostly like I really don't like to miss dinner.
Yeah.
And like, how can I set up my life so I can go to work every day, but like I mostly don't miss dinner.
I love that.
Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. Friends, springtime is finally here, but that also means allergy season is in full swing. I have always struggled with allergies, and I don't know about you, but I am especially allergic to cats. More on that in a second. Well, luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. The time that I use Claritin the absolute most is when I'm at my parents' house, my childhood home. They have this absolutely beautiful cat that they love and I like, except for the fact that he sheds so much. So that means that I'm basically sneezing from the second I arrive home to the second I leave, unless I take Claritin. My dad has even started having it ready for me right when I walk in the door. Are you ready to live life as though you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. Claritin, thank you so much for sponsoring our girls' night. We love having you. I'm so glad that you talked about that, because that does feel like a weird, hard thing to say. It feels like when you have kids as a woman, and like, this is not an expectation on men. And I like, it's just not that it's like, you should want to be with them all the time. And if you don't, there's something like wrong with you. And so I remember distinctly reading you talking about how like, I like being with my kids. I also really like my work. And those are both okay. And I have my best friend had her first daughter a little bit ahead of me, and she still works full time. And I remember her saying like, I am so much better of a mom because I'm not home 100% of the time. And
yes,
like I had someone right ahead of me saying that, but if I didn't, it would have been a lot harder to like own that, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it's some of this is sort of framing for yourself the like that you thought about the decision and kind of almost like having the confidence to remind yourself that like, this is the right choice for your family. One of the things people often ask me is like, you know, well, how am I going to feel if my kid calls me the name of the nanny or the name of their preschool teacher, which like they'll definitely do. You know, my kids call me the name of our babies or a nanny all the time. And I always tell people like, you should feel great because like your kid is with someone that they love so much that they're like that they're thinking about them. And like, that's like an incredible privilege. But I think you do sort of need the reminder to yourself, like, why am I doing this? And it's what makes our family work.
Yeah. Yeah. And that there are different configurations of that. Have you found, what have you found in terms of data on like kids' well-being when it comes to like the different childcare options of, you know, someone, one parent full-time at home, nanny, daycare, like whatever.
All of the, so there's two general takeaways from this. First of all, it's really hard to distinguish any of these choices from their sort of ways in which they're wrapped up with socioeconomic status. And so that's like, it's just very difficult to draw really strong, precise conclusions. To the extent we have data on this, it would suggest the effects are in a variety of directions and are all very small. So, you know, attendance at daycare, like it raises kids' cognitive performance. There's like test score performance early in school. Maybe it has a little bit of a negative impact on behavior. Both effects are super small and basically, you know, die out over time. You know, stay-at-home parents, like part-time versus full-time. Maybe there's a little bit of an advantage on some things or one, a little disadvantage. Like everything is just very small. And so almost for sure, any effects like that are going to be outweighed by the other considerations in this, like what does the parent want to do with their time, what feels like the right thing to do, what works financially, all of the like sort of adult parts of the decision, I think basically take precedence because you can make it work for your kids. It can work for your kids in any of these, in any of these configurations.
Is there like, okay, these last two specific questions are like, I'm asking for a friend. This totally isn't for me. when it comes to preschool or types of school, is there any data to suggest that like Montessori is better than Waldorf, is better than whatever your neighborhood school is doing versus whatever?
So there's one kind of pretty robust result in the sort of school. And here I'm talking about like kind of like elementary school, older kid school literature. There's one sort of pretty robust result, which is that class size matters. So generally smaller class sizes are better for kids in terms of learning. And I think that's, if you sort of said like, what's the one takeaway you'd have from that literature? It's that. So that doesn't mean that's the only thing you should be focused on. But if you, people ask me like, what's one thing that you would kind of pay attention to when thinking about differences between schools or even between sort of preschool setups, that kind of number of kids per teacher is a sort of pretty relevant thing. But when you get down to the question of like Montessori versus Reggio Emilia versus like, you know, this, that, there's nothing in the data that would say one of these is better than the other. And the answer is almost certainly that it varies based on your kid, right? So there are sort of particular features of some of these programs which are going to work better for kids who like more structure and kids who like less structure. So it is like, there's no substitute for thinking about your child and how they are going to react to some environment. And when we get focused on the idea of like, what's the best, we miss that there's almost certainly not a right answer to that for all children that is the same. But that there might be for yours. Yeah. I mean, I think it would be naive to say that every child would react to the, to every environment the same way. I mean, I think that's not true. So going into whatever choice you're making with the idea of like, how can I see my kid fitting into the way that this school is operating? I think that's a much more important question to ask than like, what's the average kid doing in this? Because your kid's not the average kid. Your kid's special.
Yes. okay. My last asking for a friend question is potty training. Mm. How are you doing on that? We have scratched the surface, but we are not fully.
Yeah.
We haven't done any sort of like pantsless weekend yet.
Do you remember? Do you think about like when we were 20 and 25, and you'd be like, "We're gonna have a pantsless weekend." You'd be like, "That sounds amazing."
Different.
That's not what that means.
There's far less,
so much less
bodily functions involved. Far less cleanup. Oh gosh. Okay. What tips? Yeah.
So, we actually have what I think is a really good post on parent data about this, where I asked people about potty training and we got a little bit of data about how long it took. There's some sort of general pieces of the data, which is like the older your kids are, the less time it's going to take.
I remember that specifically. That's what I cite when people go, have you started potty training yet? And I'm like, no. I mean,
wait until they do it themselves. High school seems good. Yeah. But the other thing that's, I think, useful about that post to read before you like embark on any pantsless weekends or anything is the sort of realization, like this is really hard for a lot of people. Like this, it's like, some kids adopt the pantsless weekend, like for many kids, like the sort of do it for 3 days, you kind of get a good start. And then it takes a little while after that. Some kids really struggle with this. And I think it becomes a source of like tremendous stress for parents. So if you can have your kids bought in, that is, I would say that's the thing that comes out of people's reports. Like if your kids can be excited about it, like that's going to get you way farther, particularly with older kids where they have much more control. Like if they decide they don't want to poop in the toilet, like they can hold it for like a really long time. And that's not good for them. So the more you can like get your kids bought in, the more luck you are likely to have on the other end. Okay. And they will eventually use the toilet. I mean, it does happen.
I'm banking on that. Like at some point, yeah.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen. I mean, but like one of my kids was 18 months between potty training for pee and potty training for poop. It's called stool toileting refusal. It's actually quite common. Yeah.
Okay. So. Okay. All right. Well, I am a Parent Data subscriber, which we'll link to that in the show notes. So I will go check that out. I wanted to ask just sort of last question. We've talked about different things that we don't need to worry about. And like with food, you were saying, you know, these 40 things that you maybe shouldn't eat, let's like clear those away and just be like, well, okay, let's not smoke. What does actually make a difference? Like if there are just a couple of things that we're like, I'm really going to focus on this.
Well, let me give you two answers to that. So one is somebody asked me the other day, like, you're always saying all this individual stuff doesn't matter. Like, but, you know, there are a lot of differences, you know, say across socioeconomic groups and how kids are doing. And like, so it must be that some things matter. I will tell you that like what really matters the most is a stable home environment in which your kids have some place to come home to at the end of the day, where they like have a stable place to sleep and enough to eat, and they are not in the middle of, you know, intense family conflict all the time. Talking to them, reading to them, those are basically the things that show up big picture in the data. And those are really good to do and really important and something we should be supporting for everybody to be able to do, but also are not in this specific, like you need to give them all the wooden toys or the organic snacks, like the kind of stuff that's like that's in your head. So that's kind of one answer, which is like, if your kid's going to sleep, you know, safely in their bed with enough to eat, and an environment with people who love them, like you're winning. And so are they. I think that's pretty important to keep in our heads.
Yeah.
And the other thing is sometimes people ask me, like, you're always telling me not to be afraid of different things. Like, what are the things that you are afraid of for your kids? And my answers are cars. Like, cars are dangerous. I mean, everybody drives in cars all the time, but just like reminding ourselves, like, whatever safety profiles we can take with cars, that's good. Pools are really dangerous. You should have a fence around your pool if you have a pool. You always need to be watching kids around pools. They're just really surprisingly dangerous. And my other thing is messing my kids up emotionally. And I don't really know how to fix that. That's just like my stuff.
My parents are both doctors of psychology.
Okay.
Practicing psychologists. And they, my dad always jokes that he's like, well, you have to have something to talk about in therapy someday.
I just wanted to be a relatively limited set of things.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, that's awesome. Emily, I am going to link to all of your stuff on our show notes. I'm going to continue buying your books for every pregnant person, a new mom and people who don't have kids, and they'll be like, why'd you give me this? And I'll be like, because it's good. I don't know.
Just in case.
Yeah, just in case.
Just in case.
Really, thank you for the work that you do. And thank you so much for making the time to come on the show.
This was such a treat. Thank you so much for having me.
Friend, thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I cannot tell you how much it means to me to have you here at Girls Night. Before you go, I would love it if you do two quick things. The first is to subscribe. Subscribing to the podcast is the best way to make sure you never miss an episode. It's also a way easier way to listen because it's a way of sort of bookmarking the podcast. You never have to go looking for it again. Your app will just automatically download the next episode when a new one's released. The other thing is that it would mean so much to me if you would take just a second to leave a rating and a review for the podcast. The way that iTunes knows to suggest the show to new people is by the ratings and the reviews. That's how we invite new friends to our girls' nights. So, would you do me a huge favor and take just a second to leave a rating and a quick comment about how you like the podcast so far? It would help us out so much. And thank you so much to all of you who've left those beautiful 5-star reviews already. I can't tell you how much it means to me. All right, friend, that's all we have for today, but we'll be back next week with another episode of Girls Night. I'll see you then.